Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is the Soundcheck Podcast.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Coming up in a little while, a visit from John Doe, the singer and songwriter who founded the L.A. punk band X, and then the Americana band The Knitters, and who is now looking back at 20 years of being a solo artist. Oh, and he's got two new films that he's starring in. John Doe will play live for us in just a bit. Here in New York this week, though, people have been thinking about dancing, mainly because one of New York's storied venues, the Roseland Ballroom, is closing after 95 years of live music and generation after generation of dances, from the Charleston to disco to the mosh pit. We're going to take a look back at the history of the ballroom in a moment. But fans of a certain kind of dance music have been thinking this week of Frankie Knuckles, known as the Godfather of House. Chicago's house music scene of the 1980s has had a huge influence on the sound of electronic dance music over the past 30 years, and Frankie Knuckles, who died on Monday at 59, helped to birth that sound. For many years, he DJed at Chicago's The Warehouse, a bar that catered to a largely black and Hispanic gay community, and it's possible the name house music actually was a reference to The Warehouse. But that Chicago-based post-disco sound would go global, driven in part by songs like this one, a hit on the international club scene in 1989 called Your Love, from the late Frankie Knuckles. Love, a classic piece of house music from Chicago by the late Frankie Knuckles. Knuckles, who was actually a transplanted New Yorker, died this week at 59. And you can hear echoes of house music all over today's dance music landscape, right on up to the music of Lady Gaga. That's the sound of Lady Gaga playing this week at New York's Roseland Ballroom. The famed Midtown nightclub and dance hall is set to close its doors on Monday following Gaga's seven-night run, and it means the end of nearly a century of concerts and dance nights at Roseland. So, with another legendary New York club closing its doors, it's time for another installment of our Soundcheck series, Vanished Venues. We'll hear about the history of the Roseland Ballroom in a moment, but first, we're joined by Ira Robbins, the music journalist and founder of the magazine Trouser Press back in the day. He reviewed lots of shows at Roseland over the years. Hey, Ira.
Hey, John. It's good that I actually kept my notes for those shows.
I guess so. Well, what was your first reaction when you heard it was closing?
Kind of routine. You know, New York's always changing. I mean, they're still trying to fix it, you know, and it's been my entire lifetime.
So where would you sit? I mean, in the musical ecology of New York City, where would you situate Roseland Ballroom?
Roseland served a very valuable purpose because it's large. It holds 3,500 people, which makes it bigger than pretty much everything except Radio City.
Or Madison Square
Garden. And Madison Square Garden, which are, you know, far, far larger. I mean, Radio City is like 6,000. So, you know, for a mid-sized band on the way up that can fill a room of 3,000, it was perfect. And a lot of rock bands and metal bands and punk bands found it a very conducive venue.
And so what are some of the shows that you saw over the years that stick in the memory?
Well, Nirvana and Fugazi. I saw Green Day's first show there that when they were opening for Bad Religion, and my notes were like, these guys are pretty good. They could go somewhere, which was exciting, you know. But I also saw weird things that in retrospect seem very surprising now, like Billy Bragg headlining as a solo artist, you know, just him and his guitar. You know, that seems kind of shocking for 3,000 capacity.
Yeah, although when you're called the Roseland Ballroom, maybe the shock is to have bands like Fugazi and Nirvana, you know, amps to 11, you know, in a space like that.
I also saw the Sex Pistols there do their Filthy Lucre reunion tour, which I have a vivid memory of a stockbroker standing next to me singing along with No Future. And I was trying to imagine exactly what sort of No Future he was envisioning for himself.
So was it, on balance, a good place to see a show?
It was comfortable because it was so large that you could roam. When it was crowded, it was difficult, and the sound wasn't ideal. But when they finally moved the stage to the back, and I don't mean to get ahead of ourselves
here. Yeah, we'll come back to that. But you mentioned seeing Nirvana. You saw them in the summer of 93.
Yeah, they did a last-minute announcement show that was tied into the New Music Seminar. They were just about to release the In Utero album, and they hadn't played pretty much in the States in about 2 years. You know, kind of Nevermind had been this huge explosion in 91. It's kind of stretched out for that whole year and probably into 92. And then they pretty much backed away, and so their playing the show was a big deal. My review of it in Newsday was kind of negative. They were not really together, and my recollection of it was that Kurt looked more uncomfortable on stage than any human being I've ever seen. He basically was like stock still and miserable looking.
Huh. Well, let's hear how he sounded, him and the rest of the band. This is Nirvana, live at the Roseland Ballroom, July 23rd, 1993. Song School from Nirvana, live at the Roseland Ballroom, July 23rd, 1993. Ira Robbins was there. And Ira, you remember him as being really uncomfortable on stage? RollingStone.com, in their bio of Kurt Cobain, says he overdosed in his New York City hotel room before that concert.
I suppose that could have happened.
And would explain
a lot of things.
Yeah. So Ira's here with me in the Soundcheck studio, this edition of Vanished Venues, celebrating a venue that is in the process of vanishing even as we speak, the Roseland Ballroom, closing with Seven Nights by Lady Gaga. And also joining me is Laurie Holcomb Holland, who is a contributor to the New York Times, and she compiled a really neat timeline of the Roseland Ballroom for the Times. You can see a link to it on our website, soundcheck.org. Laurie, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how far back, how long a history are we talking about with this place?
We're talking about quite a history. And, you know, one of the things that I really love about this is that it all started with a guy just wanting to dance more with his girlfriend. At the time, Lewis Brucker was a student at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And he and his girlfriend, Dorothy, who would later become his wife, they loved ballroom dancing, but ragtime was really big then. There weren't many places to do ballroom dancing, so he went and built one. In Philadelphia, right. That's opened in 1917 with a $20,000 investment from the Yuengling family. And
Yuengling beer?
That's right.
Oh,
exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, things went great. He actually paid back the initial investment within the first 6 months, and things were going well. But you know what? He wanted to dance with his wife, even longer. And Philadelphia had these blue laws that wouldn't allow them to do it. So he came to New York, checked out the scene here, really liked what he saw. New Year's Eve of 1919, they open at 51st and Broadway.
As a dance hall.
That's right. Well, a ballroom.
A ballroom.
Mr. Brucker did not want it to be called a dance hall at the time. He thought, you know, ballroom was
more refined.
Exactly.
And it was for a brief period, whites only, right?
For a while, actually. It wasn't until 1924 that black bands were hired, and even longer until black customers were allowed in. But it was sort of known as the home of refined dancing for whites.
Although in 1924, when they do start allowing black musicians in, they're getting the best of the bunch.
That's right. Fletcher Henderson, his orchestra, were there for quite a while. And the fall of 1924, that's when Louis Armstrong had his New York debut.
Louis Armstrong making his New York debut with Fletcher Henderson's orchestra back in 1924. Fletcher Henderson's orchestra with a young Louis Armstrong on trumpet with Sugarfoot Stomp, a recording that goes back to the 20s when Louis Armstrong made his New York debut with Fletcher Henderson's band in 1924 in the Roseland Ballroom, one of our vanished venues here in New York. Ira Robbins with me, the music journalist, and Laurie Holcomb Holland, New York Times contributor whose Roseland timeline she compiled for the paper, in which you can link to on our website, soundcheck.org. Now, Laurie, that's a recording, obviously, but in 1923, 24, 25, if you're dancing, you were probably dancing to live music, right?
That's right. And at Roseland, they would actually have two bands in a night, so you could kind of have your... You could have your choice.
So you could have a white band at one end and a black band at the other.
That's exactly right. Mm. Yeah, it was a little bit of a point of contention for some of the white band leaders.
What? Oh, because were they being like, was there a battle of the bands going on?
There was a battle of the big one that everyone talks about was when the Gene Goldkett Orchestra came from Detroit, and that was supposed to be the cream of the crop of the white players, and Fletcher Henderson's band had the cream of the crop of the black players. And it was actually, from what I've been told, different historians I talked to, the Gene Goldkett Orchestra won basically because Fletcher Henderson's band, they didn't really expect them to bring much to the table, and they didn't know about some of the musicians that were in, who would go on to become very famous musicians who were in the Gene Goldkett Orchestra.
So they underestimated their competition, basically.
That's right. That's right. I don't think it happened very often that Fletcher Henderson was busted.
So it sounds like, and Ira, this sort of goes back to what you were saying about how big the place was, that it would accommodate two bands, although I can't imagine you could have had them both going simultaneously. It's not that big a space.
Yeah, but they probably weren't amplified.
No.
So, I mean, I would think an acoustic group at one end probably could project 100 feet and the other one could project 100 feet.
And you think they could... Yeah.
Probably blurry in the middle, but, you know, the Coventry and Queens used to do that.
That'd be a fun thing to be in the middle there and hear both bands simultaneously. It sounds, Laurie, like a place that was just built on a love of dance.
That's right.
And yet, virtually every dance trend from the 40s on, at one point or another, was banned there.
That's right, exactly. It was built on a love of ballroom dancing.
Uh-huh.
So there was a time when I actually read that the Lindy Hop was banned for just a little while because one of the taxi dancers had broken her arm.
To explain what a taxi dancer is.
A taxi dancer, or Mr. Brucker would have called them a hostess because that's more refined. But it's a sort of a rented dance partner. You could pay by the dance or you could pay by the hour. let's see, I believe it was in the 40s, they were going for three dances for 35 cents. Mm. And when they opened, they had 150
taxi dancers.
That's right, yeah. Wow.
Hence the phrase, my dance card is full.
Is that really where that comes from? Mm-hmm. How about that?
Well, they filled out cards with the names of the people they were going to dance with.
Wow.
You know, it's one of the things I was researching last night more about the taxi dancers. They had some rules that they needed to follow. They actually kept them in a little corral where they were mm-hmm. safe from the ne'er-do-wells. and some of the rules, first of all, there was no exchanging phone numbers or arranging dates. Undergarments had to be worn at all times. That's right. And then
I love that they even needed that as a rule.
I know. Who broke that rule that it had to be established? And then no gum chewing and no slang talk. He wanted his ladies to be ladies. And that, yeah.
So. Okay. So at what point do they ban the twist?
So the first that I read about it was in 61, that he basically said that...
This is Brecker, the guy.
Brecker, yes. Said
so
that,
in 61, he's still running the place that he founded in 1917 in Philly.
That's right. That's okay. Right. And, you know, along
so
the way...
So he's a cranky old man and...
Yeah, that's sort of, I mean, yeah, it's when you kind of look at the history of Roseland, for a long time, just as we tend to do as we get older and get set in our ways, it seems like Roseland sort of was too, and this was, you know, this was Mr. Brecker's baby, and he banned the twist, and I love, there was a quote from saying that, you know, his children told him he was crazy for doing it, but the other places that allowed it, they were closed, and Roseland was still open, so, you know, must have been a good decision. But so Twist was banned, and then soon enough, when his daughter Nancy eventually takes over, those things that have been banned eventually mm-hmm. come back.
And by that point, Ira, the original Roseland on 51st Street has moved. It moves, like, overnight, right? Or the same day.
Oh, in the same day. Mm-hmm. They... Dorothy and Lewis danced the last dance there, and then went that at 1 a.m. it closed, and at 7 o'clock it opened at the new location a block down, and they danced the first dance there.
Yeah. So, Ira, tell us a little bit about, you know, the location. It seems like an odd place for a lot of the kind of music that would eventually come there.
Certainly in the context of New York, where most rock clubs have been built in kind of far-off reaches of the city because real estate is cheaper, you know, the idea that you could pretty much get off the subway, you know, and walk a half a block in the middle of Midtown, you know, on 52nd Street and Broadway and be at a venue was always kind of surprising. You know, I mean, everything else was like on Avenue C or,
right,
you know,
right.
You know, in Queens or, you know, on the Lower East Side or, you know, the West Side very far over. So
And you would walk past Studio 54 when...
If you were coming that
if
way,
if you were
yeah,
coming from right. one of the subways.
Generally, I walk past Entertainment Weekly magazine.
Here's a couple of listener memories. Radek on Facebook leaves us this memory of... Portishead. He says, despite sitting on my couch in the Czech Republic, I truly enjoyed the band's ethereal, touching sound. Beth Gibbons, smoking a chain of cigarettes, found the show to be mind-opening and so mind-blowing that I wish it never stopped. Portishead must have felt similarly because they actually released a recording of that Roseland show.
Bow and arrow, I'm gonna give my heart away, leave it to the other girls to play. For I've been a temptress too long. Just give me a reason.
Bit of vintage trip-hop from the English band Portishead. The song's called Glory Box from their album Roseland NYC Live, recorded 1997 here in New York at the Roseland Ballroom, which is closing on Monday night. This is a part of our occasional series, Vanished Venues, and we're not even waiting for the venue to vanish. Ira Robbins, the veteran music writer and co-founder of the legendary Trouser Press back in the day, with me here in the Soundcheck studio, and New York Times contributor Laurie Holcomb Holland. Her timeline of Roseland's bumpy history is linked on our website, soundcheck.org. When did they move the stage, Ira?
I crowdsourced this on Facebook last night, and the closest I can come is 91. I definitely saw Adam Ant and Big Country there in the 80s when the stage was in the center of this huge rectangular box on a long wall in the back. And basically the sight lines were terrible because mm-hmm. unless you were standing directly in front of it, you were looking at a pretty severe angle.
Well, also acoustically.
Yeah, you bouncing know, off the back
yeah,
wall.
Yeah.
And when they finally moved it down to the far end, basically made the venue like a long tube, a long box with the stage at the end, and they took the old stage and made that the VIP area. So yeah. the press used to stand up there and be gawked at by the audience.
Which is something that our listener Ian here in New York City remarked about in his voicemail. Take a listen to this.
One of the greatest shows was the Red Hot Chili Peppers headlining, and two as yet unknown acts, Pearl Jam and Smashing Pumpkins. But I have to say, Chili Peppers were in their element. Yeah! Oh, yeah. Watching them over an eye-level sea of moshers was an incredible way to experience that band. Thanks.
So that's back in 1991 that Ian saw the Chili Peppers and the Smashing Pumpkins and Pearl Jam at Roseland Ballroom. So the press corps would be on the old stage.
Yeah, which they elevated like 6 feet above the audience, which right. felt very conspicuous.
And Laurie, I mean, all of this is happening after a second change. I mean, you talked about Brecker passing it down to his daughter. She eventually sells it, right?
That's right, in 1981. Sold it, and that's when you started seeing a lot of events that led to some major changes there.
Like what?
One patron was actually killed on the dance floor, and then a few years later, in 1990, there was a tourist from Utah who was killed in the subway by a few kids who
were... Very famous
yes.
Murder in the subway.
Exactly. And Brian Watkins, I believe
right.
his name
yes.
was. And there was some kids who were... They wanted money to go to Roseland. And it was shortly after that Roseland decided they were no longer going to do their disco nights.
Right. And four of the guys were arrested in Roseland,
That's
as
right.
I recall.
That's right.
Well, and at that point, you know, you start to see more concerts as opposed mm-hmm. to, you know, these disco nights,
That's right.
nights of people just coming to dance. We're talking about the Roseland Ballroom, which is closing for good on Monday when Lady Gaga concludes her 7-night run there. Soundcheck listeners, do you have memories of Roseland? You can leave them on our website, soundcheck.org, tweet us at soundcheck, or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Ira, once we start getting bands in there, as you mentioned, it's a big spot. You start getting big bands, and you even start getting the mega bands scaling down
there.
A little.
Bob Dylan played there, Metallica, Megadeth. Yeah, I mean...
The Rolling Stones.
Right. I mean, it was a fairly flexible place to play. It's a big stage. When they moved it, the room was very deep, so it had that feel of like a big audience. It wasn't this sort of sense of like people crowded around the stage. I mean, you could be a good couple of hundred feet away, and it had a balcony that had pretty mm-hmm. good sight lines.
Well, let me read you a comment from Jason in Brooklyn, who writes, "Ugh, let's be honest, the Roseland was a terrible place to see a concert. It was a dance hall and built like one. The venue was long and narrow, which meant even in a non-sold-out show, you were always super far away from the stage. The stage was low, there were no risers, made it hard to see the band, the sound was terrible, and the location was awful."
But other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you like the play? I mean, but every rock venue in New York has its limitations. I mean, you know, if there's a crowd, you can't see. If there's a stage, it's either too high or too low. You know, and sound systems are very, very hard to control in large environments. So, you know, I mean, that argument can probably be made about pretty much any place in New York. I've never walked out of a venue in New York and thought, oh, my God, this is the greatest place on earth to see music.
Yeah, although, you know, it was a big box, and it did have a kind of boxy sound.
Yeah, so does Hammerstein. And, so does Terminal 5.
Yeah. Yes, Terminal 5 definitely does. But, you know, then you have places like the Beacon where the sound can be quite nice.
Right. And, mm-hmm.
All right. So what does Roseland's demise say about the New York scene, the music scene?
Constantly changing. You know, I mean, you know, when CB's died, it was that was a huge big deal, especially in my world, because I come from sort of the indie rock underground punk world. You know, and the world didn't come to an end, even though people kind of predicted it would. And, you know, Roseland, okay, let's check one off that list and there'll be another one. You know, it's only a place to see music. It's not a lifestyle, you know?
So it is not likely to be the last vanished venue that we cover on Soundcheck. Ira Robbins has been with me, the veteran music writer, and Laurie Holcomb-Holland, contributor to the New York Times. Check out her Roseland timeline. It's full of really interesting bits of history from the Roseland Ballroom. Link to it through our website at soundcheck.org. Laurie, Ira, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you, John.
As I mentioned earlier, Lady Gaga is performing the final shows at Roseland, and if you don't have tickets, you can watch a live stream of the very last concert on Monday, April 7th. You can find a link and leave your memory of Roseland at soundcheck.org. Speaking of live shows next week, join Soundcheck for two nights of music and conversation that we're calling Gig Stock, inspired by our daily Gig Alert. We're teaming up with the indie concert site Oh My Rockness for the first night, with performances by Pains of Being Pure at Heart and Parquet Courts. Wednesday, April 9th at 8 p.m. For tickets, go to soundcheck.org. Thanks for listening. Stay connected by subscribing to the Soundcheck podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and download the new WNYC mobile app for free. See you next time. I'm John Schaefer.